Do you know how many times I've set the intention that on Sunday, I'm going to get up, I'm going to plan my meals out for the week, I'm going to go to the store, I'm going to get everything that I need, I'm going to come home, I'm going to make all my meals for the week. Do you know how many times I've actually been successful in doing that? Not once, folks, okay? Not one single time. But alas, I have found the perfect solution. Meet Sunbasket, a team of dietitians and chefs that design wholesome, nutritious, and delicious meal kits delivered to your damn door. You get to pick and choose what you're in the mood for every week. Maybe one week you're feeling Mediterranean, maybe another week you're feeling a little carb consciousness. I like the sound of that. I most recently made, it was a spinach and strawberry salad with steak. It was damn good. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, then why are nearly 1 in 3 American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier than ever, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that instead of turning into fat when you consume it, turns into ketones, which is a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body. So, by getting more MCTs in your diet, you essentially flip a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which can flush out excess fat and calories. And he's created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it's a delicious drink. I love how incredible it tastes. All you do is add a scoop to water. Enjoy. And watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized. So, if you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast, go to GundryMD.com/energy and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. Again, that's GundryMD.com/energy.
Trauma is life events that are too much, too soon, or too fast for our nervous system to complete a successful survival to safety response. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am the captain of this hot mess express. And this is where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood fucked you up a whole lot more than you initially thought it did. We curse here, you've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. So welcome aboard. Buckle up. It gets weird here sometimes, okay? So today we are diving deep with Cardin Rabin. So he is a somatic practitioner. He is the co-founder of Somia International, where he offers various nervous system regulation courses. He is also the author of the newly published book, y'all, The Secret Language of the Body: Regulate Your Nervous System, Heal Your Body, Free Your Mind. That's a pretty solid subtitle there. Regulate your nervous system, heal your body, free your mind. Who the hell wouldn't want that, right? So if you listen to this past Shit Show Saturday's episode, chronic neck and shoulder pain for many, many, many years, it does not like keep me from doing anything, But by the end of the day, every day, I'm hurting. It's been slowly getting worse, and I've been meaning to deal with this for years. I've been meaning to go to physical therapy for it. And so finally, a couple months ago, I started going to physical therapy. And let me tell you, the reason that I ended up going is because the physical therapist office actually called me. I had been in to see my primary care doctor, and I told her, I said, I didn't call the physical therapist when you gave me the referral last year. Can like you please give me another one? And then it was a couple days later, I answered the phone, and it was the physical therapist's office. And I was like, thank God you guys called me, because I never would have called you. So I've started going to that twice a week for the past couple of weeks, and it's not making any sort of difference at all. Like, not at all. It's not helping. It's not making it worse, but it's not making it any better. And, you know, I just had the realization that probably the reason that it's not getting any better is because this is actually trauma shit, right? This is stored trauma in the body. You'll hear Cardin refer to this as the Cobra Hood. So let's get the damn show on the road, folks. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you, need to damn the Join Shit Show. This is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows, where you can join sub communities like Shit Show Parenting, Healing from Narcissist. We have an IFS group. We have a child sexual abuse group. We have a neurodivergent group. We've got it all, folks. This is a support community at your fingertips, in your back pocket. We have an app. That means that you have access to a support community 24/7, y'all, for less than $1 a day. For less than $1 a day. So I just want to give a shout out to the newest members of the Shit Show community. So thank you, thank you, thank you to these fine ass shit shows. Brandy, Sam, Vivian, Rayleigh, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly, Sion, Mark, Yael, I apologize again if I'm not saying that correctly, Amber, Dylan, Krista, Josh, Christopher, Jessica, Amy, Katie, Susie, Tara, Selena, Thatcher, Pora, Jake, and Donna. Thank you, thank you, thank you to you fine shit shows. How about the rest of y'all follow suit? Let's do it now. Thank you. Next, give me a follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. Oh, also too, guys, I have a YouTube channel too. Please go subscribe to my YouTube channel. You can find it in the show notes too. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you guys who have followed suit. The rest of y'all, please do the same. Thank you. Love you all. And I do know that I want you. Let's dance, let's touch. Check it right out. All right, guys. Well, you're in for a damn treat. We have Mr. Garden Raven, also known as Cardin Raven, somatic practitioner, co-author of The Secret Language of the Body. And also co-founder of Somia.
Co-founder of Somia. Yep, that's right.
Welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me.
So as you said, when we were just chatting, that you like to, you tackle things from first looking from a medical perspective, from like a chronic illness perspective, and then going into the trauma aspect of that. But I'm assuming that you probably have a personal story there. So what I like to start with is, at what point did you realize that you were, your childhood impacted you more than you thought it did initially?
So when did I realize my childhood impacted me more than, you know, I don't know why I'm going to start here, but this is where I'm going to start. So my mom died when I was 21. It was my senior year of college, and she died from complications of long-term prescribed opioid abuse. Mm. She was on 12 Percocets a day.
How long had she been on?
20 years.
Wow.
So yeah, like very whole long life. Time. My whole life. Yeah, my whole, my like, it was absolutely normalized for me to, like, I didn't know that I grew up with an opioid addicted mother until later, right? Like, so I think a lot of people can relate to that. It wasn't until, you know, from the outsiders looking in and from now looking back, it's like, are you fucking kidding me? But anyway, The answer to your question is, so I get called to the hospital and I go in to see my mom's body. And for about 2 to 3 minutes, I'm by myself. For 2 to 3 minutes, I collapse into a pile of inconsolable grief and pain. And then, as if a genie got sucked back into a bottle, 3 or 4 minutes later, it all just went away. It just vanished. And I didn't feel anything. And even though I was a 21-year-old idiot that didn't know anything about any of this stuff back there, I knew for like the 3 or 4 or 5 months after that, that the fact that I couldn't feel anything
was an issue.
And that I was an issue. Like, this is that your mom just died and like, you're fine, right? I remember my best friend, Alex, was like, dude, are you okay? You seem too okay. And I looked at him, I'm like, I know I seem too okay, but I there's nothing, dude, right? And so that was my first awareness that a lack of feeling and that emotional repression was like really not good, but I didn't know what to do about it. And I think that might be where I'd begin.
Was it unexpected?
Totally. Actually, you know, the way my family actually described it is that it was totally unexpected, but nobody was shocked. Right? Like, we kind of all knew eventually this would be the inevitable thing that happened in a way, but we maybe thought it was many years off. The timing was a shock.
When did you realize that your mother was an addict? Was there a moment when that became clear to you?
In the year or so preceding her death, we never used the term addict ever. Again, because these also, keep in mind, not only did I grow up in this, but these meds were prescribed by her physician, you know, to treat decades of chronic back pain. So it was more like, this medicine that she's on is killing her, right? And so there was a conversation going on in parts of the family about, we need to help mom, you know, get clean. But even get clean, it was just like, get off these meds, right? It wasn't cure her addictive behavior. And maybe if that conversation was going on about addiction, I wasn't hearing it.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's one thing to think about, you know, because I really believe that addiction is trauma-based. However, when the conversation comes to opiates, you know, somebody could get hooked on it who has not had an issue with drugs or alcohol before. But I don't know, are there certain circumstances that would make that person more susceptible to becoming hooked to them to begin with, you know?
You know, it's like most things, it's nuanced. For speaking for my mom, she had a hellacious amount of trauma, and opioids weren't her only addiction. You know, she smoked 6 packs of cigarettes since she was 11. Sorry, 3 packs of cigarettes since she was 11. So there was addictive qualities and issues going on all over the place. I think what I would say about what you're talking about here is that having trauma, attachment injuries, and a dysregulated nervous system fantastically and exponentially improves your likelihood of falling into an addiction. But kind of like, there are definitely people who have pure genetic propensities to alcohol addiction. And it could be like, you literally, like, had you lived, for example, on a planet where there was no alcohol for 40 years and had a really good childhood, right? Or actually, another great example to talk about is Native Americans, right? Mm-hmm. Native Americans got exposed to alcohol and it fucked them up. And presumably, you know, they didn't have a track record of terrible past. So I guess the observation is that it's a combination, but I do think that people can fall into addictive behavior, especially if they're genetically predisposed, without the trauma background. But I think in our country, since trauma is so pervasive, it's almost always part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you had the opportunity to reflect back on that experience of the ways in which that did impact you?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, when I started where I started because that was like sort of the first noticing. But, you know, my journey out of chronic pain and illness required healing my nervous system, which required looking at the original injuries, the traumas, or what we call in our work, the embers that were the genesis of those coping patterns. And so I was fortunate that it's interesting. It depends on your parent, even if they have an addiction, where that addiction really, really negatively impacted you. And also, in what capacities was that parent still a decent source of safety and connection?
Mm-hmm.
And on my side of things, my mom's, I suppose, main wound was her utter and pervasive absence. I was just
mentally, emotionally, or physically.
So this is the interesting thing. So I put it like this. She was physically absent almost all of the time, right? Mm-hmm. When she was physically present, even though it was always the Samantha show, always, because there were definitely significant self-centered behavioral qualities going on all the time, she still was. She saw us. She was affectionate to us, right? She definitely liked us as adults. She liked us more as adults than children, if you will. So there was this, when she was present, it was like, you know, the light of the world was there, even though it was always on her terms. Mm-hmm. But that was such a minority to just like the you know, the endless loneliness. Mm-hmm. And we could go into that more, but as you might know from the research, neglect is often far more damaging than abuse.
Absolutely. And harder to see.
Yeah.
You know, and harder to get to. And it was so insidious in my family too. And I think about that my mom was like the most amazing mother in the whole wide world, like 85% of the time, you know? And I still just continue to be just blown away at how insidious some of this stuff is. And when the abuse is more blatant, it's a lot easier to spot, you know?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, sometimes it is insidious. And I use this analogy of one of the ways you find the wounds, one of the way that you find the problems is, Andrew, do you know how they find black holes in space?
No.
So you can't see them. And so the way you find black holes in space is that you look for other stars and other sources of light doing weird things, bending in weird shapes, being refracted in weird shapes, showing different spectrums of wavelength, because all those things mean that the light is traveling through some gravity well that warps it as it approaches the Earth, and then the telescopes see them differently. Mm. And so, for example, we could take a coping pattern like people-pleasing. You see the people-pleasing, but you cannot have people-pleasing without a black hole,
mm-hmm.
right? And the black hole is the wound or the trauma that behavior was created to help compensate for. And this goes for absolutely every chronic symptom, behavioral disorder, or even, you know, most DSM diagnoses, which I don't subscribe mm-hmm. to. All of them are features trying to escape, navigate, survive, not be ripped apart or crushed by the black hole that's hidden.
Mm. I've never heard that analogy. That's amazing. I'm obsessed.
You're welcome.
Yes. Did you come up with that yourself?
I did.
Wow. Nice.
It's one of the things that I was brought into this world for was metaphors.
It was that
for
in particular. So good. What role did you play in your family? Or how many siblings did you have?
I have one blood and one step.
Okay. And what role did you play?
I don't think I'm going to use the classic language that you...
That's fine.
I know that you're very into this stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think that we can have mixed roles.
Yeah, totally. And actually, you know, when we look at our work from a nervous system perspective, Jen and I, we even look at almost every role, any attachment style. It's which form of the survival response is happening. So is this a derivation of a flight characteristic, fight characteristic, right? Mm-hmm. And how it's often blended. Like I start off anxious and then I eventually ballistic into avoidant, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that depending on the relational context or the intensity, that changes. But what role did I play in my household? I'm one of those guys that doesn't remember a lot about his childhood.
Okay.
Yeah. So I might pass on that one.
Okay. So talk about the unfolding. So you had that moment and realizing with your mom, her passing away. And then how did your medical issues start to, first let me ask you this. Prior to that experience, did you think that you were somebody that stuffed their emotions?
It's interesting. It's like even to have that self, did I even have that much self-awareness mm-hmm. before then? And it's like, I didn't have that much self. Mm-hmm. You know, I say for a lot of people, we are truly automatons. We're like asleep at the wheel of ourself and our life, like completely asleep. And I really mean that. It's like we wake up and then something happens and we wake up in the movie mm-hmm. theater, mm-hmm. right? We've been in the movie for as long as we've been in it, but we've been fully asleep in the mm-hmm. audience. And then we wake up and all of a sudden we're like that true self, that perspective, that ability to reflect comes on. You're like, I'm 19 and I'm just waking up to myself mm-hmm. or whatever. But yes, I can look back and when I look back now and also through the help of other ways of contacting my emotional state, I had massive emotional, mostly horrible emotional experiences throughout my childhood. And like any other kid, I learned to repress or disassociate from them and just live mm-hmm. in my head and play video games all the time.
What system?
Oh, I was so I was a Genesis kid to start, right? Then PlayStation and mm-hmm. then Xbox and then StarCraft. Speaking of being pervasively lonely, right? The Sega Genesis was my salvation.
N64 was where it was at for me.
Yeah. Well, should we play some Smash Brothers?
Fuck yeah. Yeah.
Or some GoldenEye?
Yes, GoldenEye. Do you remember when you played multiplayer? There was always like there was like the one that was like the temple and the GoldenEye gun was always like in the very bottom, like in this very bottom room of the temple. I just always remember that.
All racing for it, right? Mm-hmm. By the way, I don't know. Do you still play video games?
No, but I would if I had one.
So I went back and tried again because I haven't in like 20 years.
Is there too complicated?
Well, no. I tried playing OG ones.
Oh, okay.
Like I to be honest, like I felt so much anxiety.
Really?
And that anxiety was there when I was playing back then too. That's just a separate thing about like kids and playing video games, being stimulated and excited, but also the amount of anxiety that was present with those games.
Diddy Kong Racing didn't get the appreciation that, like, everyone talks about Mario Kart, but I thought Diddy Kong Racing was pretty solid. So
it was, but it was a minor title.
Yes.
So I kind of lost my track there, but yeah, I was kind of known for like, also when I'd get really hurt, I'd go into silent treatment mode mm-hmm. and I was known for having kind of a temper and definitely holding grudges. My anger was my greatest defense mechanism against the just horrible, more vulnerable emotional things going on in my body.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the unfolding of your discovery. So where do we go?
Yeah,
so you realize that your mother, you have that first moment with your mom, and then where do we lead?
Well, then we forget about it. We get on with our life. I start pursuing. It's interesting. My sister went into intensive therapy and I went into like yoga and meditation. And I kind of criticized her path and she criticized my path. And yeah, in this very intellectual and aware way, I went into spiritual bypass.
Mm.
Again, knowing that I can't feel these things, but working with a lot of mindfulness, working with a lot of power and now stuff, working with yoga, but really just not seeking or out the emotional pain, not really a priority. But what started to happen in my early 20s is I started to get really bad low back pain.
Mm.
And this was, besides being really painful and unfortunate, after college, I went to massage therapy school and I became a body worker. And that was how I made my living. And so I was very good at getting people out of pain using body work, functional movement, structural stuff, you name it, most body work I'm trained in. And I loved it. And I looked at pain exclusively through a mechanical lens, right? Low back pain is because you know, your hips aren't aligned, or your core is not strong enough, or, you know, your iliopsoas is too tight, you name it. And although I was often having success with clients that I was working with on getting them out of pain, like I built up a great reputation as a very skilled body worker, two things were happening. One was sometimes, no matter how aligned, strong, and flexible I got a client, or they tried to get themselves, they were still in pain. Mm. Right. And for me, over the course of a decade, every couple of months or so, when my quote back would go out, it would get worse, mm-hmm. and worse, and I'd be debilitated for longer and longer. And I, at its climax, I was in uninterrupted pain for 7 months straight, including bilateral shooting pains that felt like ice picks being stabbed into my calves, lightning storms of electric pain in my groin, in addition to my back. Like, it was really bad. And nothing, none of my formidable skills or the skills of my chiropractor or my osteopath or my acupuncturist was really having any impact. And I was moving towards surgery, which, by the way, it was a back injury and a double spinal fusion.
Well, I was going to bring that up with your mother.
Right,
yeah.
Right. It was in her early 30s. It was a back pain followed by a double spinal fusion operation that put my mom into 20 years of opioid treated pain. Mm-hmm. So it's like, here's this horrible, horrible irony, this fate that I've done everything in my power not to walk down my mom's surgical drug footsteps. Mm. And now I'm considering surgeons for this pain, you know? Mm. And what happened, Andrea, is I was in all this pain. I was down on Long Island teaching the anatomy and physiology component of a yoga teacher training, right? So here's just more, I don't know if it's hypocrisy, right? Like, here I am, this specialist teaching about this stuff and teaching about it well while in pain, right? And in between teaching and the breaks, I'd just immediately start laying down with my legs up the wall because of the pain I was in. Mm. And on the bookshelf of the yoga studio owner was a book called Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. Do you know him, Andrea?
I've heard the name.
Yeah. So first, when I saw this book, something you should know is that I have a very healthy opinion of myself.
Okay.
And I was even healthier back then. All right. So when I saw this book, especially with all of my fancy pants knowledge, I eye rolled so hard that I think I almost cracked the front of my skull. Right. Like, what could this book? Right over here. I keep it close because it saved my life, or at least started the path of mine.
Have you met him?
I did not get a chance to meet him, and he passed away in like 2018 or 2019 at the age of 93. Mm. I'm like, what could this book teach me? But I took it off the shelf anyway, because I had to go to the bathroom and I needed something to read. And so while on the commode, I read the first chapter of this book. And Dr. John Sarno, who is a physician it's in New York City. Why can't I remember the rich person? Rockefeller Center for Medicine. Essentially points out that most of the orthopedic explanations for the pain that people were having in their low back were scientifically and medically insufficient to explain their pain. Like, this doesn't, A doesn't equal B. All right. Mm-hmm. But what he did see was an extremely high correlation of type A perfectionist emotional repressors presenting with these chronic pain syndromes. Mm. And he describes you in the book, and you're like, up, oh, check, up, oh, check, up, oh, check, fuck, up, oh, check, up, oh, ah, eek, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ah, right? And two things happen at once, especially for, you know, although I was very, again, confident in my abilities, I've always been super open-minded and I really like things to make sense. And so first, his argument that, like, your body's not broken. This is not because of your L4, L5 minor herniation. Mm-hmm. This is not right. Also, he points out things like, why does it hurt when you do X, but not when you do Y? I want everyone to hear this, okay? If you have a low back injury and you're like, it bothers me in the car, but it like doesn't bother you when you do a squat, or doesn't bother you in other situations, or it gets randomly worse when you're more stressed out. This is not an orthopedic injury. This is a nervous system related problem, because the only organ in your body responsible for creating, generating pain is your brain. It's the only one. And we might talk a little bit more about that. So, but anyway, in this case, it basically says your coping patterns and your emotional repression are what's driving these chronic pain patterns, largely to allow you to avoid experiencing a pain in your body, an emotional pain in your body, that your brain deems as more threatening than a physical pain.
When was that book written?
So he's been doing this work since the 70s. This book was published in 1991.
Okay.
And actually, and his first book on the subject was written in 84, when I was born. So his theories, we've moved well past his theories and really gotten much more into the mechanistics of why this stuff works. Mm-hmm. But the point being is that he was correct.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm in this agony. I read this book and I immediately start feeling better. Mm-hmm. My pain decreases by almost 80%. But what was necessary is that my pain would return. And what you start getting trained to do, and what we do in our program, we lead a program called the HEAL program, is that your symptoms, your chronic unexplained symptoms, whether it be low back pain, IBS, migraines, hives, complex regional pain syndrome, fibromyalgia, CFS, most post-viral syndromes. I was going to say like Lyme and COVID, but what were you saying?
Autoimmune.
Yeah, and a huge amount of almost all autoimmune disorders are rooted, what we train is rooted in nervous system state. And this is a very broad term we use for the subconscious, and it's only subconscious because you haven't been trained to listen to it. The autonomic nervous system states that include sensations, emotions, desired behaviors, memory, image, and that as long as these nervous system states are in place and unmetabolized, for example, my enormous amount of repressed anger and grief, anytime there's a stimulus in your life, or if you're stuck in a state of unconscious grief or repression, grief, anger, or repression, the symptom will manifest. And so to answer your question in a very long way, is that I had to journey into my nervous system, into my body, into my trauma, into my attachment injuries, and into my repressed emotions to get myself out of agonizing physical pain and illness.
Was that a hard pill for you to swallow upon first reading that book? Or it was, or you felt like just relief because you had been trying so many things and nothing was working?
Did you ever read The Body Keeps the Score?
Yep.
Did you felt seen in that book?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd already like read quite a bit by that point. It wasn't like a huge, I mean, yeah. I think I felt really seen when I read. Yeah. Yes, well, I've had that experience. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so I think whether it be The Body Keeps the Score or Sarno's book. And also because here's a big thing in our space. This work it almost never works to like give this knowledge to someone It's in a way like, you know how they say you can lead a horse. What is it? Lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, or is it a camel? Yes.
I think it's a horse.
Yeah. In our work, you can't even lead the horse to the water, right? The horse needs to stumble so exhausted and fucked up and desperate to the watering hole. And then they then have to take that extra step to drink. Right. So I have learned in this, you know, in this work, my activities are always I've written a book, I'm obviously on Instagram. I share openly
the breadcrumbs
all the time, the breadcrumbs, right? But you can almost never say do this because it doesn't work. But in short, no, there was no resistance really at all to what he was proposing because I was seeking and ready.
How close were you to scheduling your surgery?
Me and my primary were still evaluating surgeons. So I would have said it was probably like 3 to 6 months out.
Mm-hmm. You know what I think is so interesting when you're talking about just how the back pain was, you know, continuously getting worse. And then thinking about my experience and the way that my trauma showed up was like that I was in more pain in each new relationship, mm-hmm. you know, and how it's the same thing.
Well, it's by the way, it's just a little of the science behind that.
Mm-hmm.
So we talk about there's this association that gets formed. The higher the level of fear associated with the thing you're doing,
mm-hmm.
the greater the intensity of the coping patterns, whether that mm-hmm. be symptoms or behavioral, right? So it's like, for example, when you start getting low back pain and your back goes out, each time your back goes out, there's a higher level of fear of how bad this is going to be, mm-hmm. how long it's going to last. And then, by the way, it requires even less input for the pain to start, right? You start now saying like, ooh, sitting is dangerous, squatting is dangerous, doing all these things is dangerous. And your nervous system goes into basically a full-blown survival response in relation to your low back. Now, if you are going into relationship after relationship, which your nervous system like, these are fucking dangerous. These are fucking dangerous. Exactly. These are fucking dangerous. And then any, even forget red flags, yellow flags will activate you going into cray, cray, cope, cope. It just gets worse. The cycle goes deeper and deeper each time. And it happens faster and harder. Even mm-hmm. if the relationship or the thing hurting your back isn't as bad as things in the past.
Exactly. Doesn't matter. It's a fun time. Or I guess
the smoke alarm basically becomes more and more sensitive each time.
Yeah. And the hypervigilance, right? Yeah. It's rough. What do you think that is, that for some people it shows up in physical pain and for some people it shows up in relationships? What do you think that's about?
I think that if you look, that there's always a blend. Very few people who have a traumatic past and are in stressful relationship dynamics don't have symptoms, right? Yeah. They might think it's fine, but like, I mean, I'm talking about like brain fog, confusion, fatigue, pain, high levels of physical tension, hormonal imbalances, thyroid. Like, just, I'm going to ask you, Andrea, did you have any physiological problems during all those periods?
I still do, I think. Yeah. No, I mean, I think I need to start looking at it from a somatic perspective. I just started going to physical therapy. I've been just ignoring. I mean, my neck has just been screwed up for so long and I've just been putting it off. And I started going to physical therapy and of course it's not really doing much. So yeah,
right.
I have so much tension.
And we like to say that, you know, the body is always doing what it's doing for a reason. And mm-hmm. so where you're demonstrating that one of the things that I call where you're pointing to the back mm-hmm. of the neck, the back of the shoulders, I call that the cobra hood.
Yeah. Well, because you're like,
well, not just because of the shape. No, think about it neurologically, think about it behaviorally, think about it in terms of a protective response. The back of your body is where your startle and threat orienting system comes from. So anytime there's a threat coming into your space, or if you're being vigilant, Andrea, all of that depends on your eyeballs and your neck and your head orienting, which it means mm-hmm. looking and finding for the danger. Now, most of the time, you are supposed to have a pretty chill cobra hood. The hood's not up. You're just kind of a nice little chill snake going around, nice S-shaped, supple muscles and body. But if you grew up in an environment where unpredictably your mom would become a fucking psycho, okay, mm-hmm. or you were looking for the signs that were leading towards that,
mm-hmm.
then your cobra hood, the mechanism, the brainstem level mechanism of eyeballs, base of the skull, neck and shoulders, becomes permanently on in this almost semi-incomplete startle and orienting response. And so how do you get the neck and shoulder muscles to start releasing? And by the way, you do that chronically long enough, you get pain, you mm-hmm. get weird postural stuff. But how do you get that stuff to release? Yes, body work can be lovely. Stretching can be lovely. PT can be helpful. But if it's chronic and it's not responding, until you somatically train the nervous system to no longer have to be in cobra hood mode, it will stay. And that's what we do. And that's a different insight. Mode. It's like, the question is, why is the nervous system doing that to that part of the body?
Mm-hmm.
So yes, I almost everyone presents in a blend, but people are usually pretty durable to physical pain. They become so good at ignoring their emotions, they also can ignore their physical symptoms until they become crises.
Absolutely. So true. What were some pivotal points in your journey as you read this book? Were there some pivotal aha moments from going for your own particular healing and with your back? Like, what did that look like?
All right, my shit show ladies, let me tell you about how I can make getting dressed so much easier for you. Armoire is a clothing rental membership where you get to build your perfect wardrobe with brands that are high quality, unique, and recommended just for you. All you gotta do is take a 5-minute style quiz and then select from your personalized closet. The styles show up at your door in as little as 2 days. Then when you're ready for new clothes, just swap them out for more new to you styles. So I love this because I'm on video quite often on interviews and social media content, and I don't want people to be like, is that the only shirt that this girl owns? I also would not consider myself in the know of what's hot and what's not. But with Armoire, I get to pretend like I'm a fashionista. So this is perfect for working moms, for stay-at-home moms, for any women who just don't feel like going to the store. Now, right now, you shit show ladies can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off your first month. So that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/adultchild. That is armoire.style, armoire.style/adultchild to get 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear ever again. Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway, night sweats, poor sleep, feeling tired all the time, bloating, gas, man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today. Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? So Katherine Heigl, you know her from Grey's Anatomy, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says that she's seen more issues with dog joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to improve any dog's health: their food. So what she's discovered is that the way many dog foods are made can actually create toxins that could be wrecking our dog's health. But fortunately, she has found that by just adding a few special superfoods to her dog's food, she saw huge transformation in their health. And she has made a 20-minute video explaining step-by-step how anyone can do this same thing to see incredible changes in their dog's health. Now, y'all know I'm a cat lady. Y'all know that Kiki is the queen of the shit show here. But I watched this video and there's actually some things that I can apply to her health. So hopefully she'll live another 15 years or so. So go to badlandsfood.com/adultchild and watch Catherine's video. Again, that is badlandsfood.com/adultchild.
Yeah. So I guess we'll just keep going through this story back then. It's interesting. I'm talking a lot about, instead of talking about my work now, I'm kind of talking about my work then, but that's nice. And I'm enjoying it. And it's just,
it's a nice personal story. People like to hear the personal story. So
yeah. Yeah. And it's a walk down memory lane. So, okay. So I read Sarno's book and he overemphasizes
the emotion of repressed rage. That's his, in fact, you can watch it. His last documentary, which is fantastic, before he died, was called All the Rage. All right. And so, okay. So he says, I have rage. I need to. So what I would do is
like,
I
fuck
would.
Fuck you. I don't have rage.
you son of a bitch. No, I believed him. And so I would lay down on the ground. And I would bring all of my attention to the pain in my low back. And I would say in my own head, into my body, I'm like, Doc Sarno says there's anger in here. And I'm like, and I'd say like, show it to me. I want to feel it. And I'd stay there. Mm-hmm. I'd like literally lock myself in a room for an hour. And I would then also, I just lay there. I'd have my attention on it. I'd be looking for the anger. And I'd also go to like little associated memories where there would be puffs of anger, but then they'd get snuffed out. Just like how I had that emotion with my mother and then it would get snuffed out. Mm-hmm. But when you just kind of lock yourself in a space and lay there and you're determined, it was amazing how eventually, like bubbles from a cauldron, I started to feel the heat and contraction of an enormous amount of repressed, and not only repressed, cumulative.
Mm-hmm.
Cumulative. Two decades of so much anger. And then if you had been a fly on the wall, Andrea, you would have seen someone basically having an exorcism. My body would twist and I'd contract and I'd go, and I would all of this very native, somatic, primal, pre-verbal anger that had no outlet, but it was basically like this contained nuclear reaction in my low back started to finally move and metabolize. And by the way, no words. I wasn't talking to anybody. I wasn't analyzing myself as I was doing it. It was just really, really raw. And then by the end of like one of those 10 or 20 or 30 minute sessions, my body would feel, although it was actually kind of scary, I'm like, holy crap. Like, it would almost feel like, I can't believe this is here. It was so well repressed, it felt alien. Yeah. But at the end of that, my body, every muscle in my body, the low back pain would be gone and every muscle in my body would feel absolutely delightfully limp and exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by the way, we teach that in a much more safe, contained, supported, and regulated way in the HEAL program. And I don't actually recommend for most people to do what I just described because it's scary and it can be
dangerous.
It's dangerous. And the nervous system actually doesn't love catharsis. It doesn't. It likes incremental, safe, adaptive change. That being said, that's how I did it when I was trying to get out of this pain, 9 years ago by myself in a dark room without any help. That was one thing. But then what was more important and what has been far more life-changing and what was at the root of the pain wasn't the rage. What was at the root of the pain was the much harder to feel tears and grief.
Mm-hmm.
Right underneath. So it's like the anger had to be burned through. It had to be metabolized, almost like an oil slick on top of water in order to finally drink the water underneath, which was the terrible sadness. Hurt of that boy being alone all the time. Mm-hmm. Right. And then the last beautiful thing is that as the rage got burned off, and then as the sadness was something that my body was able to learn wasn't going to kill me, my emotional palate came back.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning I could feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm. All these stuffed emotions, repressed emotions, how were limiting beliefs showing up at all in that process?
Superficially, I don't have a lot of limiting beliefs. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is like, I was game to do this work. On the surface level, like I said, I've been lucky with a pretty healthy ego and self-perspective. But And so I think that's what made me be able to start this work, being like, I can do this.
Yeah.
I didn't have, there was not a voice in my head that was telling me, that was criticizing me.
I didn't have one either. Like, that was kind of the same thing for me. Like, consciously, I thought I had high self-esteem, high self-worth, but like my actions in relationships were clearly showing me that there was a part of me that clearly didn't think I was very lovable, you know? So I can relate to
that. Oh, totally. Yeah. And so then when I got into the work, right, like this whole edifice of a highly competent, wicked, smart, very handsome, charming guy is completely constructed around a very simple core belief, mm-hmm. which is I am a fucking freak of nature. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even unlike you guys use this word unlovable. Like that was probably in there, but like, no, the boiled down experience of self was that I was some like freak show in a cage mm-hmm. and no one could see it mm-hmm. and no one would ever be allowed to see it, because what else could explain one, the fact that nobody's ever here for me, ever, right? Like I'm alone all the time. But not only that, inside this aloneness, like I was this little boy with TNT level energy, mm-hmm. right? And I would be in all this pain, and I'd also do all these like freaky behaviors. Like I would smash my head against the sheetrock in my bedroom and just like put holes in it, right? And then I'd get yelled at, right? So like, and also I grew up with horrible asthma. I was hospitalized all the time. I had migraines. I was sick all the time. I'd be puking all the time. Mm-hmm. All of this stuff was because of this pervasive feeling of dread and aloneness that I mm-hmm. didn't know about and that no one else knew about. But like, it all just reinforced the fact that like, whoa, I'm a freak. And so I've been obviously through inner child work, through parts work, through years of this work, mm-hmm. I have been remodeling and loving and healing that deeply core belief that like, I am an unlovable freak. Mm-hmm. But I think because of the coping pattern, and also because I know this is odd. Remember how we said like our parents, like in other ways were like, because my parents, I know this sounds odd. I always knew my opinion mattered on things. I was involved in adult conversations and decision-making. I was obviously acknowledged for my intellect. Mm-hmm. And so that's a coping pattern, but it's also a real resource, right? Like there is this part of me that is authentically confident and capable, mm-hmm. even though it might have been spawned or poisoned by having to try to protect and overlay onto a freak. One more thing I want to say, Andrea, here is that I don't think coping patterns are random. I think coping patterns take advantage and leverage our natural gifts mm-hmm. that then basically kind of like Gollum style get poisoned by the ring, okay? But it's like, no, if you strip, like when people say like, oh, you're a people pleaser, it's like, yes, I'm a people pleaser. But if you were to strip away the trauma that made that a coping pattern, I am wired as a caretaker, and mm-hmm. that's a virtue, right? It just becomes unvirtuous when it gets poisoned and hijacked by the coping mechanism.
Absolutely. I think that my curiosity is one that can go that way too.
Yeah. And we're not, it's like, remember, actually think about how we started the call. Cause one of the things that I've mm-hmm. enjoyed about listening to all of your podcasts is that I love your inquiry. Your inquiry is so fucking strong. It's so good. And it's so exciting. Right. But then I can also see how that curiosity, if let completely off the leash, it could go curious about, I mean, doom scrolling could be your favorite thing in the world. Right. Those kinds of things.
Yeah, maybe. Yes, absolutely. So, okay, do you want to talk about, and I think you were touching upon this and you thought maybe we could talk about this more later, but as far as the brain not being able to tell the difference between physical and emotional pain?
Yeah. So what we actually see in fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging scanning, is that especially with people who have chronic pain, mm-hmm. that the same neural pathways get lit up for physical pain as they do emotional pain. And so what this creates, believe it or not, guys, is a rather Pavlovian association between certain emotional stressors and the literal wiring and firing of physical pain pathways. One of the things that we do in our work is something called provocative testing. So provocative testing, ooh, let's all try it. Andrea, close your eyes.
Okay.
And in your case, you're going to bring your attention to your cobra hood.
My cobra hood, yes.
Your cobra hood, right?
Snake lady name, yes.
But someone else, let's say they have chronic low back pain, they could bring their attention there. Someone with knee pain could bring their attention there. Someone who has gut issues could bring their attention to that. Someone who has allergies or even sinus issues could bring their attention to that. Doesn't matter, whatever it is. And while your attention just gently hovers there, Andrea, we're going to use you in this case. I want you to think about like something that activates your vigilance. Like maybe it's even something as simple as like feeling the text ding on your phone.
Okay.
But you want to think, or like maybe you're in a parking lot and like there's someone across the way that doesn't like look so great. Okay. And your goal is, as I bring this thing to my mind, do I notice any shift in the tension, rigidity, pain, breath in my body as I simply think about that? With someone with, for example, with low back pain, if it's caused by their commute to work and they're sitting on the couch right now listening to this, they can think about their commute to work and notice, ooh, wow, I just got some tension or a little spike in pain just from thinking about the thing. It could also be a constriction in breath. It could be an elevation in heart rate.
I notice it as a constriction in breath.
Yeah. Now, with time and practice, you'll notice how that telescopes out to certain areas of symptom. So simply imagining the thing that causes the pain or the discomfort, because it's caused by actual the stress response, is enough to provoke the action. And what we end up doing with people through brain retraining, through embodied practice, is we start safely teaching them how to uncouple, to shift out of a survival state relative to certain stimuluses like going to work, conflict with their spouse, medical anxiety, you name it. We focus on shifting and bringing their survival state back into a window of tolerance, back into what we simply would call useful neurology. And then the nervous system starts learning, whoa, I don't have to go to DEFCON 1 anytime on this situation. It unlearns the no longer useful survival patterns associated with certain circumstances. And then often, most of the time, spontaneously, the symptoms go away. Because the symptoms don't get created if the body isn't going into an active survival response relative to the thing. Or if the body isn't going into rigidity to repress and shield against emotional pain. Because that's another part, right? Like if I've deemed sadness or grief or rage as unacceptable experiences, I have to repress that energy somehow. And that usually comes at the expense of a body system.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. With your book, what were you trying to bring forward that you feel like what isn't already out there? What's unique about it? Or where do you feel like folks are going wrong as it comes to somatic healing?
Well, what do you think the most trendy, when you look at this space and maybe you see things breath that you work. Think are, okay, great. Breath work. Anything else?
Probably. What methodologies?
Yeah. So breath work's hot, right? Yeah. So breath work's all over the place, right? Tickling your vagus nerve is all over the place, right? Yeah. So our book is called The Secret Language of the Body, as opposed to a pile of nervous system biohacks for mm-hmm. a reason. At the heart, your mind and body, your nervous system's safety is a conversation and a relationship. In order to work with that system and actually change your neurology out of the patterns it's lived in its whole fucking life to keep you alive, which, by the way, as you know, were bloody glorious and necessary, and they got you to where you are, mm-hmm. but they are usually extremely bad tactics for the now.
Mm-hmm.
You need to do three things, and this is what we teach. We call it the AIR approach. AIR stands for awareness. Your nervous system, its least favorite or useful language is words.
Yeah.
Its primary languages, and again, if you know, its primary languages are, feelings. As Peter Levine would summarize, sensation, mm-hmm. right? Behavior, affect, which is emotion. Image, he uses image, but that's all kind of sense memory. You are, as I like to say, you're an adult duct taped to a child, bolted to an animal. And if you are trying to heal yourself and care for your nervous system, only speaking adult language and not getting into child experience or animal level physiology, you will not succeed. You will not. It'd be like trying to get around a foreign country not speaking the language. So awareness comes first. You have to be aware that your body is speaking in this nonverbal language, and you need to learn then how to speak back to it in a nonverbal language, the same way that a parent in the first couple years or more of raising a child, almost all of that regulation is communicated physically, vibrationally, emotionally, in terms of contact. Even in that first year, your words, the words you don't matter, the tone and the prosody matters, right? Mm-hmm. So this is first, is that if you want this work to work, forget, and that's why even then we'll get to breath work for a second. I love breath work, but it's an asymmetrical, it's not a conversation, right? It's the imposition of technique on your own body. It's coercion into calm. Okay. Mm-hmm. As opposed to actually being a really beautiful conversation of, whoa, what state is my body in right now? Oh shit. I'm actually really scared because that fight that I just had with my partner is really making me feel with withdrawal, rejection, and abandonment. You know what? Let me actually use a box breathing technique for 2 to 3 minutes just to lower my survival response, get a little bit of my neocortex back online. But what I really need to do right now is some embodied inner child work. That's what I need right now, right? But I can't know that if I don't know the conversation. So that's awareness.
Yep.
Then the next step is, after awareness, and many of your listeners probably have awareness either intellectually or some of them even have it somatically. The next part is, that shit ain't gonna change itself, y'all. It won't, all right? The brain actually is not particularly fond of learning new tricks, especially when it comes to ways of keeping you alive. Mm. Whatever worked, it does not like to replace. And so like all forms of habit transformation, you must interrupt the freight train of old patterns. And so that's the second step. You become aware, then you interrupt. And that is where, again, breathing, somatic exercises, vagus nerve exercises, tapping, clapping, dancing. I don't care. Whatever, we teach you a lot of these things, but you must interrupt what's happening. And you must interrupt it in such a way that you bring it back towards regulation so that the interruption not only stops the survival pattern, but temporarily makes you feel better, as I described a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
Last but not least, AIR. R is redesign. Now I need to, in both a mind but body, very somatic way, start replacing not only the felt sensations, but the actions that I do in response to certain triggers. And that takes awareness, interruption, and redesign. It takes time. It takes application. It takes discipline. But due to the wonders of neuroplasticity and the fact that your mind and body isn't stupid, when it's finally really, really supported in learning new tricks that are better and that make it win and make it feel better and make it survive the world better, it's on board.
Hmm. Can you give me some examples? R?
Yeah.
Yes.
Of R. Yeah. Okay. So because my deepest core belief about myself is that I'm a freak, what that means both in mind and body is that when, for example, when my wife withdraws from me, not only, you know, is there this, so let's kind of do it in reverse here for you. If my wife withdraws from me, my typical unmetabolized old coping patterns are either going to be, how can I basically like fawn and appease and do anything to make her happy again, to make her come back, right? Mm-hmm. And again, this is not noble. This is not, oh, I want to help her. This is, I'm trying to make her like me again so back. I don't feel like shit,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or two, that's, so by the way, that's more of like the, that's more of the anxiety, the appease, the connection response. Mm-hmm. When that fails and you get rebuffed, well, now I'm going to crank it up to fight. Mm-hmm. Now it's F you, you suck. What's your problem? Get away from me. Why can't you handle your shit? This ain't fair. Do you see everything I do? That whole fight response, and that's also part of the avoidant response as well, is because the other responses didn't work, right? And I still mm-hmm. feel terrible. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So now what do we do? I'll just run you through it.
Please.
So if you've read our book or done our course, you develop the awareness to not only see that superficial pattern, but through the guided explorations of your somatic experience, you feel the dagger that strikes you in the chest when she withdraws. You feel the physical emotional pain. You feel that collapse and that, and then you also feel the sadness and the fear. You may even feel that, holy shit, this is exactly how I felt 1100 times in my childhood. Mm. You've got that level of awareness. Mm-hmm. All right. Now that that's happened, I need to interrupt this.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have lots of interrupting techniques. But one of them might just start being with, oh my God, this is awful. This is really bad. I've got a lot of energy. I'm going to do a chest pounding. I need to interrupt the experience that's happening. I need to do anything or something to make myself feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now in the redesign step, you apply it in real time, but you actually do this work on your own.
Mm-hmm.
The work would be like this. One, how do I start having a new mental picture, a new felt experience? How can I start gathering evidence, allowing myself to see, believe, and feel that I'm not a piece of shit? That I'm not a freak. What does that even feel like? I have to practice what that feels like in my body to even know it's a place I can go to when I'm going into the shame, sad, freak, collapse spiral, right? Mm. I need to know where that lily pad is. But that lily pad doesn't exist, but we can teach you how to exist it. Like, for example, you could actually, we'll often give people the practice of sitting somatically, and then bringing to mind the face or the face of a mentor or a teacher that actually made them feel like they were a decent human being.
Mm-hmm.
That's the seed, that's the germ that we use to start growing that sense of self and capacity in the body, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that in inner child work, we could work, like, remember, as you're a child, anything bad happens to you becomes self-referential. The reason why we all develop these ideas that we're a freak or unlovable or unbroken is that it's inconceivable and unimaginable
to think that our parents are the ones that are responsible. It's too scary. They're responsible for our survival.
Yeah. It, and that's what I'm saying. It's, you say it's too scary. It's just, it's not even
a possibility.
Correct. It's not, it's literally not even a possibility, mm-hmm. right? It's like that. Yeah. And so since that's not possibility, it was not available to the child to be like, hey, Cardi, that was my nickname when I was little. Hey, Cardi, this horrible pain that you're feeling, one, it's fucking real. That's real. But your explanation is hilariously wrong. This is because your mom is a traumatized narcissist that's addicted to drugs, okay, and having and also is in like basically having sex with her business partner, and that's why she's not coming home, right? That's not a possibility. So the self-referencing child can come up with the answer. That the only one that makes sense, which is this must be because I'm no good. I'm the problem. And it's just, guys, I want everyone listening. This is physics. Physics are laws of the universe that are immutable. Okay. All of our coping patterns and our the nuances of our core beliefs about ourselves, they have many different flavors and many different shades, but they all follow physics. There's only a couple ways that a kid can survive X environment, and they're always going to do it in the three or four kind of ways that that's possible. Their specific little flavor might be a unique little emoji, bitmoji of themselves, but there's only so many ways. So now, as I've practiced in the book or the Heal program, or whatever you do, establishing these new neural pathways, this embodied felt sense of self where, whoa, I'm not worthless. And really helping the child redirect. We're not trying to get rid of the sensations that are awful. They're there, right? When my wife withdraws, those are there. I want to be with those sensations and realize I'm not going to die. That's a big part of it. But also to then be like, hey, this is because of something that's going on for Jillian, not me. That's such a huge chasm. But when you can shift that belief, it changes your whole life. It's still the first place my nervous system goes, but I catch it quickly, right? Like, it's kind of like, you know, when they describe meditation, someone once asked the meditator, how do you stay centered all the time? The meditator says back, I'm not centered all the time. I just come back faster than you, right? I'm not impervious to feeling pain or having withdrawal happen. And then all of a sudden for a moment, feeling that hit of I'm a freak, I have to fix this. But within seconds, because of the work, my body can soften around that. And I can put in place the, we're okay. This doesn't feel good, but it's because of what this person's going through right now. And I have a choice to be here and support that person, or I can get out. But I'm not going down the pathway of I'm a miserable bastard and that's why this is happening. Unless, in fact, I am a miserable bastard, which I think might happen sometimes.
Occasionally. Just wondering. How has all this showed up, like, in being a parent?
I am forever grateful that I stumbled into huge amounts of this work before I became a parent. Simply because I'd say here, you know, people ask me all the time, what can they do for their kids? What can they do for their kids? What they can do for their kids? What can they do for their kids? And the answer is like, there's nothing more important than you developing a embodied practice of your own, because kids weren't designed to be taught regulation. They were designed to be in the presence of it and therefore acquire it.
Yes.
Okay. Osmosis, folks, not instruction. And I've seen it all the time. I don't know if you've met any of those really smart, really read up on the books attachment parents who are anxious as fuck. And their kids are dysregulated. And it's because no matter how much you talk the talk, if the organ of your heart, if the cells in your body, if the brain in your skull and the vibration coming off your body is not communicating a level of ease and safety and groundedness to your children the majority of the time, they're uniquely attuned to you, and they know it. They want, not only they know it's bullshit, but then they start copying you. Mm-hmm. So one, I'm glad that I had a good amount of this before going in. And that is where, you know, meditation and yoga, even if you're not working with your crap, can be helpful, because you learn how to at least have a body that can know how to be at ease, at least when it's not triggered, right? So that's a big thing. The work that I've been doing on all my inner child work and being access to my emotional pain, I think that one of the biggest things that it does is it makes me not want to, obviously I don't want to do that to my kids, but when there is rupture, right? Mm-hmm. Or when I am in a bad mood, when I have gotten angry with my kids, or when I've been so triggered and they've so overwhelmed me, and I've had that moment of being like, you don't give a shit. You don't care at all about your sister. It's all about, you know, you have that crack.
You're able to repair.
You like the velocity with which I can repair is critical. And also my desire to repair is higher because my empathy for my own pain as a kid is stronger than my rage and annoyance. Mm. Right. And I'm like, I never want my kid to feel, at least for not very long, anything that I felt, right?
Yeah.
Last but not least, though, remember this, guys, and this is the hardcore research. The healthiest children come from homes that are in one third sink, one third rupture, one third repair. One third, one third, one third. I will never stop saying that. So if you're in a house that's fucking rupture and craziness all the time, that's the worst. But also, as you know, from like the kids who are the parent, who are the children of psychotherapists, where there was never any overt conflict. And those kids have big problems, and they have big problems because you have to see that there's this fine line between not being raised in terror and chaos, but you must be raised in beautiful adversity. Mm-hmm. And that means one third we're in sync, one third we're in rupture, one third we're in repair. And what that teaches children is that bad things can happen and they get better over and over and over and over and over again, so that they both can deal with adversity and come back. So one third, one third, one third. And it gives me a little slack. Like, guys.
You're
really going to laugh at me at this, but like, sometimes it takes me a couple of hours to get to the place where I can repair authentically with my kid.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I do everything I can to speed it up. But I also know that because there's just this such a repetition that she knows repair and safety will be reestablished. Mm-hmm. And now I know that one third, one third, one third is good, that it will sort itself out. I give myself a little more grace.
Where does that come from?
Ed Tronick, one of the most incredible trauma researchers of all time. Ed Tronick.
He sounds like he's AI.
Yeah, yeah, he does. Ed Tronick. You know, he's one of the most prolific childhood trauma researchers and attachment researchers. And if anyone's ever really nerdy and wants to learn about this, go to the Trauma Research Foundation's annual trauma research conference in Boston, or attend online, because it's just a bloody treasure trove of the true blue hardcore research science that underlies all this pop stuff you see on IG and on these podcasts.
What month is it usually in?
It's usually in May.
Okay.
And so it was in this past May. And again, it's great because not only is there attachment stuff and childhood stuff and kind of like, but then there's also like refugees of war trauma and neurofeedback stuff. And then there's all the neuroscientist researchers seeing how psychedelics are being involved. Mm-hmm. So also like play therapies. It really runs the gamut of the diverse range of the ways we can heal.
That's awesome. Well, what do you want to push? What do you want to shell? What do you want to sell? I'll definitely put links to everything. I'm looking forward to finishing your book. So,
oh, that's so kind. I guess I'll shell the usual stuff for endless free good stuff at Cardin Rabin on Instagram. You can also follow our company at Somia International. That's the best place to find us. And then, you know, we wrote the book because we wanted to give folks a $15 Bible on how they can really get into this work. Bessel van der Kolk is a friend and mentor of mine. And, you know, in a sense, the body keeps the score is revelatory because it wakes you up and you're like, oh my God, this explains so much about me. Mm-hmm. And then Bessel offers at least 5 thoroughly researched treatment approaches to help you heal. Mm-hmm. But all of those require finding a specialist, going out to someone, which I can't recommend enough. But ultimately, this work, as we say, it is self-healing work. Mm-hmm. No one else can do this to you. And if you want to get so much more out of your practice, out of your therapeutic relationships, whatever you're in, we wrote The Secret Language of the Body to hockey stick your abilities and to get you into that conversation in your body. So that's the next thing. And then the last thing is, although we actually didn't even talk about it this much, if you have any of the chronic illnesses, symptoms, or disorders that we kind of laced around here, or if you really know, like, oh my God, this hits. I know that these things are because of that. SomiaInternational.com, our HEAL program, is the most comprehensive, bottom-up, top-down, inside-out, community-supported, trauma-informed course for...
Is there live portions of it, or is it a pre-recorded thing?
It's both. It's you have a choice. The what's mm-hmm. always available is the HEAL program, which is completely self-study, which mm-hmm. has, you know, video lectures with Jen and I, all the practices. It's just so rich. And then we haven't done it in a year and a half because we were so busy writing the book, but twice a year we run live cohorts.
Nice. Do you know when you're going to have your next one?
October-ish.
Okay.
October-ish.
Well, keep me posted and I'll let people know. And when did the book actually come out? Just a couple months ago?
So we didn't get into this. So it was last May that HarperCollins asked us to write the book. And then we were like, oh my God, we've been wanting to do this forever. Thank you so much. And they're like, yeah, well, but you need to write it in 100 days.
Wow.
So it's been completing. So the book came out in the United Kingdom on May 23rd, and it came out here in the U.S. exactly 2 weeks ago on July 9th. Amazing. Yeah.
Perfect timing. Well, this has been great. I love this.
This really has. This was.
I'll have you back for sure.
Oh, I'd love to jam, and we could. I know there's a lot of places we could go.
Yeah.
Let it all go.